So if you take a moment to look at the flag of modern India, you'll notice something really distinct right in the center. Like, instead of a coat of arms or a star or whatever, there is this navy blue wheel with 24 spokes.
The Ashoka Chakra.
Exactly. And that wheel is just everywhere. I mean, it's woven into the very fabric of the modern Indian Republic, on government buildings, currency, you name it.
Yeah, it's completely ubiquitous.
But the wild thing is, the man behind that wheel, Emperor Ashoka, he was effectively a ghost for over 2,000 years.
It really is one of the most stunning cases of historical amnesia we have on record. I mean, we are talking about an emperor who, back in the 3rd century BCE, ruled almost the entire Indian subcontinent.
Which is massive.
Right? His empire stretched from the mountains of present-day Afghanistan all the way across to Bangladesh. He was arguably one of the most powerful men on the planet at the time.
Which makes it so crazy that he was just forgotten. So today, our mission for this deep dive is to deconstruct how this man lived, how he ruled, and then completely vanished from human memory.
It's a fascinating story.
We're jumping into a stack of historical texts, centered specifically around the Wikipedia article on Ashoka the Great. And our goal is to unpack what I can only describe as, like, the ultimate heel turn, but in reverse.
Huh, a reverse heel turn. I like that.
Right. Because imagine a comic book supervillain, like a tyrant, who literally builds a customized torture chamber, just waking up one day and deciding, you know what, I'm going to become the world's greatest philanthropist.
An animal rights activist, a pioneer of religious tolerance, it's a massive shift.
Totally.
But separating the myth from the historical reality of that transformation is what makes studying Ashoka so captivating because, well, to understand the peacemaker he ultimately became, we really have to look closely at the monster he allegedly started out as.
And the contrast is jarring, honestly. Because before he was known as Ashoka the Great, he had this terrifying moniker. They called him Chandashoka.
Right. Fierce Ashoka.
Fierce Ashoka. And the sources tell a surprisingly dark origin story for him. He was the son of the Mauryan emperor Bindusara. And you might assume, a prince of a vast, wealthy empire would have a clear, pampered path to the throne. But he was not the favorite son at all.
No, not even close. In fact, legends specifically note that his father deeply disliked him.
And the reason for that dislike is just wild to me. It wasn't because Ashoka lacked intelligence or because he was terrible at military strategy or anything.
No.
It was simply because he had rough, unappealing skin.
Yeah. Then, I mean, to a modern ear, dismissing a prince over a skin condition sounds absurdly superficial.
Like a bad teen movie turn.
Exactly. But we have to look at the why behind ancient court politics. In that era, physical perfection was often equated with divine favor,
Oh, okay.
right? Fitness to rule. So, to a highly superstitious royal court, a severe skin condition wasn't just a cosmetic issue, it was perceived as a karmic blemish.
Like the gods were saying, nope, not this guy.
Precisely. It signaled that the gods might not favor him.
But Ashoka clearly didn't just sit around the palace accepting his fate. I mean, what he lacked in his father's affection, he made up for in sheer ruthless competence.
He really did.
When a major rebellion broke out in Takshashila, which was this prosperous, geopolitically crucial city, Bindusara sent Ashoka to put it down. And he successfully crushed it.
Yeah, and later he served as the viceroy of Ujjain, which was a massive commercial hub. So he
Well,
was out there doing the heavy lifting of actually running the empire.
get his hands dirty.
Exactly. And his time as a viceroy and military commander allowed him to build fierce loyalty among key ministers and generals.
Which becomes super important later.
Very. Because when Emperor Bindusara fell terminally ill, Ashoka wasn't the designated heir, his older half-brother Susima was.
Right.
But Ashoka had the institutional backing to challenge that succession.
And here's where the texts start reading like an actual horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
According to Buddhist legends, to secure the throne, Ashoka didn't just defeat Susima in a standard battle. He supposedly hunted down and massacred 99 of his half-brothers.
It's brutal. He spared only one, a man named Tissa. And just to clarify for anyone listening who might be rusty on ancient succession politics, Tissa was his uterine brother, meaning they shared the same mother.
Right.
Because in a massive royal harem with competing bloodlines, full siblings were often your only truly safe allies.
It was a total purge of the rival princes.
But it goes beyond a bloody power grab, though. The legends claim he hired an executioner named Chandagirika. And this guy openly boasted that he wanted to execute the whole world.
A charming guy.
Yeah, really fun at parties. So together, they supposedly built a facility in the capital, Pataliputra, known literally as Ashoka's Hell.
Yeah.
The sources describe it as looking like a beautiful, serene palace on the outside, you know, to lure people in. But inside, it was this labyrinth of horrific, customized torture devices.
The psychological terror of that juxtaposition is wild. A beautiful, inviting exterior, hiding unimaginable cruelty. It's a very potent image in these ancient texts.
Wait, okay, let's pause here, though. A literal hell palace. And killing exactly 99 brothers.
This sounds suspiciously like ancient propaganda to me. I mean, these incredibly graphic stories come from Buddhist texts written centuries later.
That's true.
So isn't it highly probable these writers were intentionally exaggerating how evil he was at the beginning just to make his later conversion to Buddhism seem like a more miraculous before and after story? It feels like, I don't know, an infomercial for enlightenment.
That is a great point. And applying that critical lens is absolutely essential here. Modern historians heavily scrutinize these texts for that exact reason.
Okay, so I'm not crazy.
Not at all. The figure of 99 brothers is almost certainly a symbolic exaggeration. In many ancient traditions, 99 or 100 is just shorthand for a very large absolute number.
Like saying, I have a million things to do today.
Exactly. The Buddhist authors were crafting a specific narrative arc. They needed to demonstrate that the teachings of the Buddha were so profoundly transformative, they could turn the most wicked, irredeemable tyrant into an ideal, righteous king.
So Chandrashoka might have been a bit of a caricature designed to make his later pacifism look better.
A caricature, yes. But the underlying reality of a violent rise to power, that's supported by historical evidence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ashoka's own later inscriptions reveal a massive anomaly. There is an interregnum, a gap of about 4 years between his father's death and Ashoka's official coronation.
Wait, a four-year gap?
Yep, and a four-year delay in crowning a new emperor only happens if there is a severe, systemic, and likely violent struggle for control.
Wow.
So the Hell Palace might be a mythological embellishment, but the blood on his hands during that succession was entirely real.
Okay, so he secures the throne with undeniable bloodshed. But if we want to understand the moment that actually shattered his worldview, we don't need to rely on later Buddhist legends at all.
No, we don't.
Because he carved the turning point into stone himself. It was a verifiable, devastating historical event, the Kalinga War.
Yes, the invasion of Kalinga is the absolute anchor of Ashoka's historical identity.
Setting the stage here.
Right, so in his eighth regnal year, which is around 260 BCE, Ashoka launched a massive military campaign to subjugate Kalinga. This was a prosperous, independent region on the eastern coast of India.
And the aftermath of this campaign is staggering. We know the exact details because Ashoka openly confessed them in what is now known as Major Rock Edict 13.
A very famous text.
He writes that 100,000 men and animals were killed in action. Many times that number perished from disease and famine in the fallout, and 150,000 people were deported or carried away as captives.
It's hard to even conceptualize. To grasp the scale of those numbers in the ancient world, you have to picture hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah.
100,000 people killed by swords, spears, and arrows means looking out over a battlefield that is practically an ocean of bodies.
That's horrifying.
It represents the wiping out of entire generations, the complete displacement of a civilization. Now, the standard operating procedure for an ancient king was to carve those apocalyptic figures into a monument as a boast.
Right, like the Assyrian kings bragging about making pyramids out of their enemies' skulls just to terrify their neighbors.
Precisely. The goal is usually intimidation, but Major Rock Edict 13 does the complete opposite.
He uses the stone to express profound, deep sorrow.
Exactly.
He states that the slaughter, death, and carrying away of unconquered people is a matter of deep regret to him, which is a highly unusual public admission of guilt from an absolute monarch.
Unheard of, really.
Honestly, it reads like a leaked apology tape from a modern politician. He actually says he considers the suffering of the civilians, you know, the religious people, the householders who lost loved ones, even more deplorable than the battlefield deaths.
And this immense remorse is what pushes him toward his concept of Dhamma, or righteous conduct, and brings him closer to Buddhism.
But I notice the sources highlight a fascinating detail about this. It wasn't an overnight revelation.
No, the epigraphic evidence, the inscriptions he left behind, shows a much more grounded, gradual progression. He wasn't struck by a sudden lightning bolt of pacifism on the battlefield.
Right, it wasn't a movie scene.
Right. In one of his minor rock edicts, he mentions that he was a lay follower of Buddhism for over 2.5 years before he really started making significant spiritual progress.
Okay, so it took a while.
Yeah, he moved closer to the monastic community, the Sangha, and slowly rewired his entire philosophy of governance.
But okay, I've got a massive bone to pick with this famous apology edict.
Well, let's hear it.
Archaeologists have found copies of Major Rock Edict 13 scattered all over the edges of his empire. But there is one glaring omission. Do you know where they have never found this beautiful, sorrowful apology?
In the actual region of Kalinga.
Unbelievable. In Kalinga, the very place he devastated, that specific apology is intentionally omitted. It's replaced with completely different messages.
It is a striking detail.
So I have to ask, was he genuinely sorry, or was this a meticulously crafted PR campaign for everyone outside of Kalinga? Did he just want to look like a benevolent philosopher king to the Greeks and his border neighbors while ensuring the people he brutally conquered didn't see an ounce of weakness?
It is a brilliant observation, and it cuts to the core of how Ashoka operated. He was navigating the tension between being a spiritual seeker and a geopolitical realist.
Because you can't just be purely one or the other.
Exactly. If you publicly declare immense guilt and sorrow to a newly subjugated population that is still traumatized, grieving, and angry, you are effectively signaling that you lack the resolve to crush a rebellion.
It's like walking into a city you just burned down and saying, hey guys, my bad about the 100,000 casualties. Are we cool?
Yeah.
It invites retaliation.
It would be perceived as either fatal weakness or a deep insult. So in Kalinga, his localized edicts took a different tone.
What did he say instead?
He essentially told them, all men are my children, and I want you to be happy, but you must follow the rules. It was paternalistic, firm, and uncompromising.
Oh, wow.
And notice the ultimate proof of his pragmatism. Despite his overwhelming remorse, he didn't give Kalinga back.
He kept the land.
He kept it. He didn't liberate the 150,000 deportees. He maintained absolute control of the territory.
So if you're Ashoka, and you've just decided that aggressive military conquest is morally bankrupt, you face a massive administrative vacuum.
Very true.
Because how do you keep an empire the size of modern-day India from fracturing into 100 rebellious states without the constant threat of a sword?
Well, you replace the threat of violence with an all-encompassing ideological framework. His adoption of Dhamma allowed him to pivot from an empire maintained by fear to an empire maintained by moral cohesion.
Which is an unprecedented exercise in soft power.
Absolutely.
And this brings us into the empire of Dhamma. His policies honestly read like they were pulled from a 21st century progressive manifesto. When Ashoka talked about Dhamma, he wasn't demanding everyone convert to Buddhism.
No, not at all.
He was promoting a universal moral polity based on social responsibility.
And the policies he enacted were practically unthinkable for the 3rd century BCE. He explicitly mandated religious tolerance across his empire.
Which is rare.
Extremely rare. He instructed his subjects to respect both the Brahmins and the ascetic sects, like the Jains and Buddhists. He inscribed formal commands instructing people to not denigrate other sects, but to inform themselves about them.
A mandate to educate yourself about your neighbor's religion. That's so modern.
Yeah.
And the social welfare programs were just as staggering.
They really were.
He abolished the death penalty. He mandated the planting of medicinal herbs and the digging of wells along trade routes. And most surprisingly, he built medical treatment facilities, not just for humans, but specifically for animals.
Yes, Ashoka emerges as an ancient pioneer of animal rights. Long before any modern concept of environmentalism, he was passing laws to protect wildlife.
It's amazing.
He banned the killing of nursing female pigs and goats and their young. He outlawed the castration of animals on specific holy days.
He even turned that critical eye on his own royal household, which I love, because kings in the ancient world were expected to host massive decadent feasts displaying their wealth through endless meat, right?
Oh, absolutely. Huge banquets.
But Ashoka restricted his daily royal kitchen consumption to just 2 peacocks and 1 deer.
Wait, peacocks?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. And he even carved a note onto a rock saying, in the future, we're going to phase those out too.
I love that. He was fundamentally restructuring the image of the monarch. The standard model for an ancient king was the ultimate apex predator, the great hunter who subdues nature and men alike.
Right.
But Ashoka inverted that. The king became the ultimate protector and caretaker of all living things.
Of course, the later legends couldn't let a good thing be, so they cranked the dial up to 11. To show his dedication to Buddhism, The stories claim he built 84,000 stupas in a single day.
Stupas being those sacred mound-like structures.
Exactly. 84,000 of them.
Accompanied by a miraculous elder monk who supposedly eclipsed the sun to signal everyone across the continent to finish building at the exact same moment.
Which, again, 84,000 is likely that ancient shorthand for a massive amount.
Right.
But hearing about the sheer scale of his ambitions raises a serious logistical question for me.
What was that?
Well, it is one thing for an emperor to sit in a palace in Pataliputra and declare a ban on killing four-footed creatures that are neither useful nor edible. But this is a sprawling subcontinent filled with jungles, mountains, and deserts.
Yeah.
There's no internet. There are no telephones. How on earth did he actually enforce this moral code?
The enforcement reveals the administrative genius of his reign. He recognized that a philosophy is totally useless without an apparatus to apply it.
Okay.
So he created an entirely new bureaucratic role called the Dhamma Mahamatas.
Dhamma Mahamatas. Okay. How exactly did they function?
You can think of them as an elite class of imperial moral officers or ministers of righteousness.
Oh, wow.
They were distinct from tax collectors or military generals. Their sole mandate was to tour the empire to inspect, preach, and enforce this new welfare state.
So they were essentially ancient compliance officers crossed with traveling social workers.
The perfect analogy. They traveled the royal highway systems to ensure that the elderly, women, and orphans were being properly cared for.
That's incredible.
And they mediated disputes between different religious sects to guarantee that his edicts of tolerance were actually being practiced on the ground rather than just, you know, carved on a rock.
Doing the real work.
Yeah. And Ashoka's ambition didn't stop at his own borders. He dispatched these envoys to the Hellenistic kingdoms in the West. So to Greek kings like Antiochus and Ptolemy, just to spread this concept of Dhamma internationally.
Now, a bureaucracy that size requires an incredible communication strategy. Ashoka's solution to broadcasting his new laws wasn't just sending messengers. He used a method that left a physical mark on the landscape.
He literally carved his laws into stone.
The pillars of Ashoka.
Yes. And this was a radical shift in how power was communicated in the Indian subcontinent. Before Ashoka, royal decrees were typically written on perishable materials, things like palm leaves, birch bark, or wood.
Which obviously don't last.
Right. They decayed and disappeared. Ashoka decided to make his voice permanent.
And we aren't talking about little garden statues here. He commissioned 50-ton, highly polished, monolithic stone columns.
It's an architectural marvel.
We still don't fully understand the immense engineering effort required to quarry these massive stones, drag them hundreds of miles across rough terrain, and erect them perfectly vertical.
It's mind-boggling.
And then he topped them with incredibly intricate animal capitals.
The most famous being the four lions at Sarnath, which, as we discussed earlier, inspired the modern seal of India.
Yeah, I look at these pillar edicts like an ancient, indestructible public broadcasting system. He is projecting his policies, his deepest regrets, and his religious beliefs to the entire continent.
All out in the open.
And he did it using the Brahmi script, which is an alphabet that some scholars believe he may have helped invent or popularize.
True.
In the Western territories, he even had the edicts translated into Greek and Aramaic so the local populations could actually read them.
He was doing everything in his power to ensure his legacy would outlast him. He believed he was speaking to eternity.
But then, following his death, the Buddhist texts just go absolutely wild with more legends, illustrating how large he loomed in the cultural imagination.
Oh, there are so many stories.
Like, there's this bizarre story that his younger wife, Tisaraka, used black magic to destroy the sacred Bodhi tree out of pure jealousy. Mm. Simply because she heard him praising Bodhi and mistakenly thought it was a rival mistress.
It's a tragically comedic misunderstanding, especially considering the Bodhi tree is the sacred fig tree under which the Buddha attained enlightenment.
Oops. And then there's another famous legend attempting to explain his incredible power. It claims that Ashoka's greatness was just a karmic reward because in a past life, he was a little boy playing in the dirt who innocently gifted the Buddha a handful of dust, pretending it was food.
Yeah, the myth-making machine just went into overdrive. His legendary status flourished in Buddhist traditions across Asia.
But the reality of the historical man completely vanished. The Brahmi script, the very alphabet he used to meticulously carve his personal diary and his laws into 50-ton stones, was forgotten by humanity.
It's so hard to imagine.
How does a script just die? I mean, over centuries, spoken languages shift, new alphabets replace old ones, and eventually The symbols carved into the pillars became completely meaningless shapes to the descendants living right next to them.
Exactly.
By the 14th century, local Muslim and Hindu kings were looking at these colossal monuments in their own backyards and had absolutely no idea who built them or what they said.
It is a profound historical irony. You have an emperor who literally writes his innermost thoughts in stone to ensure they last forever, and within 1,000 years, the key to reading them is entirely lost.
It's wild.
Because the language was dead, local populations began inventing their own myths to explain the pillars. When the 14th century Sultan Firuz Shah Tughlaq moved 2 of these massive pillars to Delhi, he demanded that local Brahmins translate them.
But they couldn't write.
No, since they couldn't read the forgotten Brahmi script either, they just made up a translation on the spot.
Oh my God.
They told the Sultan that the ancient inscriptions prophesied that no one could ever move these pillars except a great king named Firuz.
Huh. Flattery survives even when language dies.
It certainly does. The silence of those pillars wasn't broken until the 19th century. A British scholar and antiquarian named James Prinsep finally cracked the Brahmi script.
And he didn't do it by magic. He spent years meticulously analyzing short, recurring patterns on ancient bilingual coins and comparing them to the pillar inscriptions, right?
Exactly. Through grueling pattern recognition, he was able to isolate recurring phrases and eventually decipher the title Devanam Priya,
which translates to beloved of the gods.
Correct. Scholars then connected that title to the Ashoka found in the Buddhist legends. And in that moment of decipherment, the mythical king and the historical author of the stone pillars finally merged back into one person.
I am still struggling to wrap my head around that. It's like someone today finding a nuclear launch code facility and thinking it's an ancient grain silo because they can't read the warning signs on the door.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought.
How does a man carve his soul into 50-ton stones scattered across a continent? And humanity just forgets how to read them. It proves that no matter how loud you shout into history, no matter how permanent you try to make your voice, you are entirely at the mercy of the people who come after you.
Ashoka built his monuments to last until the end of the world, but he couldn't guarantee that the memory of his alphabet would survive the journey. It took the combined forces of modern archaeology and linguistics to resurrect his actual voice from 2 millennia of silence.
So after unpacking this incredible life, what does this ancient story mean for you listening today?
Well, Ashoka's life serves as a masterclass in the complexity of leadership and the human capacity for radical change. He shows us that individuals, and by extension their governments, are not locked into their darkest chapters.
Right. They can dramatically alter their course.
Exactly. He wasn't a perfect, flawless saint. He was a pragmatist who maintained an iron grip on a vast empire, but he chose to use his absolute power to create an ancient blueprint for religious tolerance, environmentalism, and social welfare.
And those concepts feel incredibly relevant, even urgent, to the global conversations we're having right now.
Absolutely.
You read through his laws, you know, his bans on animal cruelty, his demands for religious respect, and you realize we are still fighting to achieve some of the standards he successfully implemented over 2,000 years ago.
Furthermore, his story forces us to deeply question how we record our own histories and what we assume will survive us.
And that is the thought I want to leave you with today. We just explored how an emperor who etched his pacifist, animal-loving philosophy into colossal stone pillars was totally erased from human memory for 2,000 years, simply because people forgot his alphabet.
Just vanish.
So I want you to think about the hard drives sitting on your desk right now. Look at our digital clouds, our endless streams of fragmented data. We generate more text in a single day than the Mauryan Empire did in a century. But if the 50-ton, indestructible stone pillars of Ashoka could be rendered completely silent by the slow, inevitable creep of time, what part of our modern civilization's memory is actually built to last? Keep questioning the history you think you know and keep digging deeper into the stories we leave behind.